Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Gift of the Outsider, What Living in the Margins Teaches Us About Faith, by Alicia J. Akins. Foreword by Jen Oshman. Narrated by Kelly A. Saunders. Foreword. Jen Oshman. I remember the first day I walked my firstborn into her Japanese preschool classroom. She wore the same navy blue uniform, hat, and indoor shoes as every other child, but she did not wear the same skin, eyes, hair, language, or culture. None of the teachers nor students spoke English, and we did not speak Japanese. My husband and I hugged her, reassured her that everything would be okay, and promised to return several hours later. When I picked her up later that day, I got an earful from her about the many ways Japanese teachers and kids are different from the Americans my daughter was accustomed to. Her first day was foreign in every way. Our American family lived overseas for years. Our kids attended school in Japan, the Czech Republic, and Germany, before we made our way back to the United States, which, according to their passports, but not their hearts, is their home country. They grew up on the outside. We parented from the margins of our communities. Our family had little in common with our neighbors. And now that we're home in the U.S., our outsider status remains, because our family forged an identity on different shores. But I would do it all again. If we were given the opportunity to raise our kids on the outside again, we would jump at the chance. Because although it was always awkward at best, and tearful on the harder days, growing up on the margins was a gift that will never stop producing fruit in my children's lives. They have a global perspective, a big worldview, an awareness of others, empathy, eyes to see. These good gifts are harder to find when you're on the inside. The cultural West, and especially the United States, feels more polarized than ever. And while we do indeed have unique pressures in our age, such as social media and curated news feeds, that invariably push us into corners and silos, humans seeking the company of those who are like themselves, those who agree with them, confirm their views for them, require little from them, is nothing new. Our flesh has always craved stasis and not change, confirmation and not questioning. But is life on the inside what God has for you and me? In this book, Alicia Akins encourages and even graciously provokes us who easily get cozy on the inside, the inside circles of our churches, workplaces, cultures, or wherever God has us. She reminds us the poor in spirit, the meek, those who hunger, and those who are persecuted are the blessed ones. Blessed are you, Jesus says, when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. Matthew chapter 5, verses 11 through 12. Counter to our culture, flesh, and intuition, the blessings for those who live on the outside are great, and the blessings for those who listen and learn from them promise to be great as well. Outsiders can see what insiders so often miss. They provide a sight where we are blind. They shine light where we may otherwise be in the dark. I've been back in the American suburbs for 7 years now. Most of my community is white, affluent, and politically conservative. And while I still feel a bit off, I am assimilating more every day. I need the views of those on the outside now more than ever. I need my friends of color to help me interpret headlines and how they hit their families differently than they do mine. I need them to talk to me about justice and reform, and I need to see up close what it's like to live in their skin. I need my friends who are immigrants and refugees to show me what it's like to start over, to flee one's government, education, status, loved ones, and comfort, and to start anew. I need my friends who are divorced, single, or living amongst families in the suburbs to show me how they cling to Christ and His people and depend on us like we are family, because we are. I need my friends who are daily, hourly, walking away from addiction, one step at a time. I need their witness that Christ is enough, no matter what. My friends on the margins preach a whole sermon with their lives, and I need to hear it. Church, what if we willingly put ourselves on the outside? What if we placed ourselves on the margin? Or what if we welcomed those on the outside in? What if we trusted Jesus when He says His grace is sufficient for you and me? What if we pursued weakness so that He might be proven strong? As you continue listening, turn to the Lord your God. May He use Elisha's wisdom, experience, and words to reveal His heart for the outsider to you. Jesus Himself lived on the margins, rejected and slain because He was the Son of God. May He conform you and me more and more into His own image. May He help you and me pursue life and friendships on the outside. Jen Oshman, author and speaker. The eye cannot say to the hand, "I have no need of you," nor again the head to the feet, "I have no need of you." On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, and on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 21 through 26. Introduction. Some look to mountains or seas, yet others to the expanse of the sky. But I have always looked to human diversity as the pinnacle of God's creative splendor. The more of its beauty I've understood, the more I've understood how many fail to see its full beauty. My curiosity around difference has grown with each difference encountered. There are so many ways to be human. It is not just the world at large that stages God's workmanship. The church, in her unique call to embody the excellencies of Christ, to evidence the power of God, and to unite in mutual submission under one head, also bears the marks of His hands. Yet since time immemorial, insularity, arrogance, comfort, power, and greed have launched sustained attacks against the church in attempts to render her embodiment of Christ's excellencies corrupt, to weaken the influence of God's power, and to foment division. This book has emerged from a patchwork of joy and sorrow sewn together over the years as I have processed what it means to be different. I share something in common with both those on the margins, to whom this book is dedicated, and the insiders I seek to convince of the profound beauty of the paradoxes of God's kingdom. With the outsider, I share knowledge of what it's like to navigate systems that by design do not work optimally for those in the margins. With the insider, I share knowledge of what it's like to benefit from systems that do. I am both insider and outsider, and I suspect this is true to some degree for most. I also share with each a commitment to glorifying God and enjoying Him forever as my chief end, knowing that both those endeavors are enhanced by living faithfully within a united yet diverse community. We'll begin our journey by coming to an understanding of what I mean when I say outsider. Then I'll examine four categories of gifts: sight, dependence, freedom, and suffering. Some categories, like sight, are broad enough to encompass a variety of outsider experiences. The others were written with specific outsider groups in mind: those who have disabilities, are chronically ill, or are economically depressed, unmarried, persecuted, or grieving. I'll conclude by illustrating implications of valuing these gifts and those outsiders who steward them well for the church. Each chapter contains reflection questions at the end, some for those who consider themselves more an insider, and some for those who consider themselves more as the outsider. This book lends its voice to a larger, ongoing discussion about how we, intricately varied as we are, ought to live together in light of the glorious kingdom to which we belong. We've been gifted a messy, yet marvelous mission that, when embarked upon faithfully, is sure to stretch us, but more importantly, to result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Christ alone can claim the credit for fashioning a community where all are recognized as essential and truly treated as such. When I first sat down to write this book, I feared I would be labeled divisive for raising the issues I wanted to raise. But I cannot be persuaded that the church is not better when we honor all its members, when we acknowledge everyone has something to contribute, and when our values are rightly ordered. I have found myself always richer to participate in groups of mixed makeup, regardless of what those lines of difference might be. My prayer is that you would walk away from this book a little more persuaded, too. 1. Who is an outsider? God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 27 through 29. Nick speaks with a stutter. Angela uses a wheelchair. Stephen was homeschooled as a child, but now, as an adult, lives in a big city. Marlene is in her 40s and has never married. Boulangerne is a new international student in the U.S. Dan has recently gotten swept up in replacement theory. Alex is an undocumented immigrant. Jasmine, a black woman, attends a predominantly white church. Mariella is a first-generation college student. John is a recovering addict. Wayne is the only man who works in his department. The Moores struggle with infertility. Sarah Kate is politically conservative, but moved to Seattle for work. Terry has lived for 30 years in his quickly gentrifying neighborhood, where nearly all his neighbors are recent transplants. Liz and Michael are the only white people on their block in an up-and-coming neighborhood. Stephanie suffers from chronic illness. Maxwell is neurodivergent. What do these people have in common? The terrors of the outside. At one time or another, and to varying degrees, The people just described have all felt like outsiders, or feared becoming one. For some, trying to recall a time when they didn't feel like an outsider proves more difficult than pinpointing a specific situation in which they did. Whether what sets them apart from the majority is visible, or something derived from personal choice or background, their experience of being different is likely similar. Feelings of discomfort, isolation, or anxiety, or the sense of being unseen. Perhaps they want nothing more than to minimize the felt difference between themselves and others as they attempt to acclimate to a new culture, even if that culture is just a new church. Maybe they carry a sense of loss, having once been on the inside. If they're at all like me, they've struggled with how their difference might limit them and frustrate their ambitions. Maybe they walk on eggshells, unable to fully be themselves for fear of offending the dominant group or exposing themselves as outsiders and facing marginalization. However else they may differ from each other, in these ways they can relate. An outsider is a person or group of people who differ from those around them in one or more ways that are meaningful either to them or to the prevailing immediate culture. Their difference may be based on life stage, socioeconomic status, education, circumstances, culture, ethnic, regional, national, ability, interests, or identity. Their experience of being on the outside may be episodic or permanent. If mapped as concentric rings, insiders, those sharing the most meaningful traits with each other, would make up the innermost ring. Outsiders would fall at various distances from the center based on a variety of quantitative and qualitative factors. In how many ways does the individual differ? How visible is their difference? To what extent does their difference prevent them from full participation in the wider group? How much weight does the group or individual put on sameness in general, or on that specific difference? What legal protections, or lack thereof, accompany that category of difference? To what extent are freedoms, power, and influence limited, or is dignity denied as a result of the difference? In C.S. Lewis's essay, The Inner Ring, he writes, "I believe that in all men's lives at certain periods, and in many men's lives at all periods, between infancy and extreme old age, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring, and the terror of being left outside." Terror may seem like a strong word, but some go to quite drastic lengths to maintain or gain privileged positions. Most people vie for the inside. When being on the inside means being known, seen, and accommodated, who wouldn't want that? If we had our way, we'd avoid the outside at all costs. My outsider story. It seems everywhere you turn, diversity is discussed. The discussions I hear most often revolve around racial diversity, which I, too, am a huge proponent of. But diversity is, well, more diverse than that. I am not limiting this exploration to racial differences, nor to only those differences I've experienced. I'm casting a wider net than most in how I think about outsiders, because the experience is more widespread than we tend to think. I was born in Kansas to Air Force parents, and soon thereafter, we relocated to Japan for a couple of years before spending 5 glorious, harsh winters in Michigan. My family was one of a handful of black families in each of these locations. I hadn't thought much about being different until after sharing with my older sister that I had a crush on a white neighbor, she told me white boys didn't like black girls. In fourth grade, I found myself in Virginia, where I finally got to interact with more black kids. It was not a positive experience for me. My black peers regularly gave me the cold shoulder or accused me of acting white when I was just being me. One black classmate befriended me just to give me black lessons during lunch. Apparently, my other white friends were all wrong and I spoke too proper. I wondered why I needed to change for my own people to accept me. At least openly, white people didn't point out my differences. And as far as I knew, they didn't seem to punish me for them either. Neither I nor my interests were particularly popular. I was that kid in school who would preemptively ask the teacher if I could work alone on group projects. Not because I was an introvert, but because I was scarred from not being chosen so often. Music was my passion, and my favorite genres were alternative, classical, and Latin. Choices the rest of my family couldn't have been less excited about. On Sunday afternoons, a local radio station would play Latin music. I would book it from the church sanctuary to the car after Sunday services, so I could catch some of it, before my sisters caught up and asked me to turn it off. In high school, I went on scholarship to summer arts camps, where most campers came from affluent backgrounds. Before then, I'd mostly mixed and mingled with those from the same socioeconomic status as my family. I still remember sitting in a Northwestern University dorm, listening to other campers talk about places in Europe they'd visited on vacation, as casually as if they were destinations right down the street. At a different camp, I'd lie in bed listening to the others talk about their favorite artisanal breads and cheeses, when I only knew white, wheat, and cheddar. That summer, I was grateful for our camp uniforms, corduroy knickers, knee socks, and polos, because they made it less obvious who was well off. I felt no love for overt signals of social status. After high school, I said goodbye to the suburbs of southeastern Virginia to study music education at Rutgers, a state school in New Jersey, where many students either knew each other or at least shared a Jersey identity. The rest of my family had or would attend historically black colleges. I had a black roommate briefly at the beginning of my freshman year. We talked over the phone once during the summer. But when she met me in person, she said, "I thought you'd be blacker." Perhaps I should have warned her. I played two less popular instruments, viola and tuba, and was one of two black string players in the orchestra, and the only woman tuba player in the marching band. As a departure from my traditional black church roots, I joined a predominantly white campus ministry. Even though I was well-liked, I sometimes felt culturally and politically like an outsider. Once, a group of us went to a state fair, and I grabbed a button from a Democratic politician's booth and pinned it to my shirt. One friend glared at me nearly the whole ride home before he could no longer contain himself, exclaiming, "I don't see how you can be a Democrat and call yourself a Christian." But as far as I could otherwise judge from our fruit, political affiliation bore no direct appreciable impact on our spiritual maturity. Other times, my difference played out in small interactions, like retreat games or conversations about childhood memories and classic performers and TV shows I'd never heard of. I met my first boyfriend through that ministry, a white guy who at least partially proved my sister wrong. His mother thrust me quickly back to reality. After our first meeting, she described me as lazy like all black people, because I told her I had a chance to perform at Carnegie Hall, but was considering turning it down due to other commitments. I wasn't black enough by black standards, but still managed to be too black by some white ones. After college, I moved to China, my first stint abroad since I was 3, and threw myself into a new language and culture. Although I was even further from belonging to the majority there, I felt a strange sense of relief to not be surrounded by the white majority, of whom I'd begun to grow weary. I moved to a new city each of the 3 years I lived there. In the smallest of those cities, I was one of 2 black residents out of a population of 1 million. I'd chosen that location because of a university there, specifically for Chinese ethnic minorities. The experience of minorities in other countries intrigued me. In the mornings, on my way to class, I had to bike past a field where soldiers trained. Every day, a different one would point at me and yell in Chinese, "Look, it's an African!" Their shocked expressions after I yelled back in Chinese, "I'm not African, I'm American," are forever etched in my memory. I stuck out more in China than anywhere else I'd lived, but I approached Chinese people's curiosity about my difference as an opportunity to be an ambassador for black people. I knew that apart from Obama, Oprah, and Kobe Bryant, Chinese exposure to black people was limited to either news headlines about our criminality or movies depicting us as underachieving students or athletes in need of white saviors. It became my mission to ensure my every interaction with them would send them home with a radically different picture of what it meant to be black. My experience in China unlocked within me an unapologetic embrace of being different. After repatriating to the States, I joined an Asian American church in Boston that significantly expanded my understanding of the Bible's stance on justice, a topic largely unbroached in my previous church experiences. I was a long way from my college church, where they taught that a missions trip wasn't a missions trip if you only met material needs. This church held it wasn't a true missions trip if you neglected those physical needs. The discomfort of that tension kept me there. I considered it good to be a little uncomfortable at church. I busied myself with Japanese classes since I wanted to keep in touch with my non-English-speaking Japanese friend. She and I moved away from China at the same time, and I worried one or both of us would forget Chinese and have no way to communicate. I also joined the Bhangra Dance Club. My house of 4 women was multicultural, 1 white Christian, 1 Jewish, 1 Indian, and me. 2 years later, I was accepted into graduate school and moved to Seattle to study China and museums. Having once been completely ignorant about the beauty, depth, and diversity of the region myself, I wanted to teach people about that part of the world. Outside of my years in China, Seattle was the first time I really felt like a religious minority. I was the only Christian in either of my programs and frequently watched classmates demonstrating open antagonism toward Christianity. I attended a Korean-American church, where I was adopted by the most amazing family, who let me spend school breaks and holidays, like Thanksgiving, with them. 1 year, after finishing the Thanksgiving meal with harabochi, halmani, and a collection of aunts, uncles, and cousins, a group of us were watching TV in the living room. A crime show came on, featuring police arresting black people, doing their best to resist. I immediately felt embarrassed. After finishing graduate school, despite hating hot weather and bugs and adoring big cities, a dream work opportunity took me, with no connections, to Laos, a tiny landlocked country in Southeast Asia, often eclipsed by its neighbors, Thailand and Vietnam. Drawn once more by my interest in what it was like to be a minority somewhere else, I worked at a museum highlighting the different ethnic groups in Laos, mostly alongside local men with just a high school education. I was the only black person living in my town.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?